Thank you, Sadaraja. That was a lovely introduction. And thanks for asking me to give this talk. As ever, it's always a really good opportunity to really look at something and kind of see where you're at with it, and what feels important to communicate. I've enjoyed that process. Yes, thank you. Bear with me with the microphone. I've had a sore throat and I'm not able to project, so I'm going to see. But if at any point you can't hear me, just kind of wave and I'll lean in closer. Okay. And I'd like to begin by dedicating this talk on the Sangha Refuge to Bhante Sangharajita, who, well, I'd have no concept of what a Sangha was without him, and I certainly wouldn't have a Sangha. Well, none of us would be sitting in this room, and I wouldn't have a Sangha to play such a pivotal role in my life, and in so many other people's lives as well. I'm so grateful to him for that. Okay. So this is the final part in a series of talks on the three jewels, and what it means to go to refuge to them. So we heard about the Buddha, our enlightened teacher. Amrachandra spoke a couple of weeks ago. She took us through the sublime qualities of the Buddha, the vision and the inspiration. And then Kulapriya gave us a talk on the Dharma last week. He went through several of the teachings and gave us a very beautiful insight into how he practices and what going for refuge can mean in that context. I recommend if you missed either of those, they're both on Free Buddhist Audio and they're both good talks, so I do recommend. I just like to take a minute to rejoice in Free Buddhist Audio. I wasn't able to be at either of those talks, but I was able to listen to them, and I'm very grateful that I was. And so tonight we're going to explore the Sangha, the community of followers of the Buddha and his teachings, and what it means to go for refuge to the Sangha. So in time-honoured tradition, I'm going to begin by defining my terms. So the three jewels are at the heart of Buddhism. The Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, they're the highest spiritual values. They're the most precious. And if you look at the Sangha jewel, which is what we're going to be doing, for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to break it down into two parts. So there's the Arya Sangha, the noble Sangha, the community of enlightened beings. And then there is the Maha Sangha, and that refers to the whole Buddhist community that is following the teachings of the Buddha. So we are the Maha Sangha. And going for refuge, the term going for refuge, is the act of placing these values at the heart of one's life. So if these jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, are the highest values, then our going for refuge is the practical realization of those values. And Bhante defines going for refuge as the total, unqualified reorientation of one's life, one's existence, one's striving, acting on the three jewels being the most precious things that there are, reorganizing one's life in that direction. And when I was listening to Amrachandra's talk, she was talking about what Sadaraja said when he introduced this series, and I hope I'm getting this right, but basically I think he said, like, the main thing about going for refuge is that the main thing is the main thing. And I think that's basically what Bhante's saying here. The main thing is that our entire lives become more and more focused on what we hold dearest, what we value most, the main thing. Bhante also says there's no question of running away from anything when one goes for refuge. There's no question of taking shelter with anyone. Going for refuge really means commitment. It means committing oneself to the Buddha, committing oneself to the Dharma, committing oneself to the Sangha. So what does that mean in terms of going for refuge to the Sangha? I'm just going to have a little sip. We go for refuge to the Arya Sangha, the community of enlightened beings, and we can do that in various ways. Some ways I go for refuge to the Arya Sangha are chanting, ritual. We did some before the tea break. I find, well, at all times, but particularly if I'm struggling, chanting can really put me in touch with my highest spiritual values and can turn my mind from my habitual refuges of anxiety, doubt, fear, to beauty, actually, to truth. Meditation, working with my mind to open myself up more and more to being receptive to the transcendental, to the truth and the goodness that is personified by the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, all the enlightened beings that there are. Images can also, like really gazing, really taking in, taking time to take in an image, can be a way of going for refuge to the transcendental, to the Arya Sangha, the enlightened beings. Study. We go for refuge by acting to bring ourselves closer to that precious jewel of those enlightened beings. I'm sure we will all have our own ways of doing that, our own ways of kind of focusing our hearts and minds more and more upon the main thing. And I think our tradition, Chiratna tradition, is very rich in ways in which to do that. So that's the Arya Sangha. Great. Okay. In some ways that seems quite straightforward. Now I have to make a confession at this point. I discovered something quite fundamental whilst preparing this talk. My understanding previously had been that you go for refuge to the Arya Sangha, to the Noble Sangha, to the Sangha of enlightened beings, all well and good. But the Maha Sangha, the wider community, us lot, basically, you don't go for refuge to the Maha Sangha, to the wider Sangha. It turns out I was wrong. In The Meaning of Conversion in Buddhism, Banti says, we can go for refuge to the Sangha in all senses, and we go for refuge to the Maha Sangha, to the whole Buddhist community, simply by our fellowship with that community on whatever level, even simply on the ordinary social plane. And he goes on, going for refuge to the Sangha is essentially a matter of communication. Where there is communication among those who go for refuge to the Buddha and to the Dharma, then there is going for refuge to the Sangha. Now, I must have read this before. I must have heard this before. But I think it was because I was sort of preparing this talk, I was just very struck that kind of communication amongst the Maha Sangha, us all, constitutes going for refuge. And at no point in his explanations, I may be wrong in this, but the way that I read it, there's no suggestion from Banti that there's a hierarchy of more important going for refuges to the Arya Sangha. It seems to me that all of those different levels of going for refuge are equally important. So it really made me think, well, what is this communication between us in our wider Sangha that I guess is so sacred? What is it? And that's what I'm going to focus on in this talk. So I looked for what Banti says about this, and he says, so what is communication? He says, it isn't very easy to say. For the purpose of exploring the Sangha refuge, a working definition might be a vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. This is communication in the context of going for refuge, a shared exploration of the spiritual world between people who are in a relationship of complete honesty and harmony. So it's clear this is not chatting about the weather or what's been on telly. A vital mutual responsiveness on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. Now, I hear the phrase vital mutual responsiveness quite often. And when I ask myself what it means, I really have to pause, which is no bad thing, and reflect. Like, can I think of times when I've been engaged in such communication? Do I understand what is meant by it? I'm not, in honesty, at all sure that I do, but this is my stab at it. And I really invite you to ask yourselves the same question. It's a very interesting question. So I think there must be different levels or aspects to this kind of communication, this vital mutual responsiveness. One thing that came to my mind is many years ago, this was back in Ipswich, I had a falling out with somebody in my GFR group, and we didn't speak to each other for about 6 months. We still managed to be in the same GFR group. We still met, and we'd be terribly polite to each other and superficial, but we weren't in good communication at all. And we had been quite close. And eventually, obviously, it came to a head. You can't continue that level of kind of aloofness, particularly in the context of a going for refuge group. And finally, we did what everybody, the wise elders of the Sangha, probably Sadaraja, in fact, at the time, was telling me to do, which was to meet and to talk. So we met in Costa's to talk. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was, to be honest, excruciating. Truly excruciating. And in the end, I remember running out of words and just looking at her across the table and just sitting there feeling wretched, feeling hopeless. And then I think I did something that was unusual for me. Instead of projecting out, focusing on the external, kind of trying to read the situation, trying to manipulate it in some way, I turned inward. And I asked myself what was going on. What was I feeling? The actual physical feelings, the vedana, the kind of going underneath the thoughts and just coming into my body. Going underneath the desperation to look good, to keep up the facade of togetherness or of being in control, being okay. And just looking at what was really there. And the answer I got was not earth-shattering. Dramatic pause. It wasn't immediately the answer to all our problems at all. It didn't make me look amazing or right or the winner. And what eventually came out of my mouth was, I don't know how to make this better. I don't know how to make this all right. And in that moment of communicating what was really true for me, in all its inconclusive vulnerability, something softened between us. It was palpable. I can remember it so clearly. And I can't remember the details of how we moved on after that, but I know that because of that communication in Costa, that time, our friendship deepened, the trust in each other deepened, and our friendship has endured to this day. We're good friends, and there's a trust there. And when I think about that exchange in relation to what Banti's saying, I think the vital mutual responsiveness is to do with being very connected with ourselves, which then enables us to be connected to other people. I mean, fundamentally, it's mindfulness of body, mindfulness of vedana, mindfulness of thoughts. And then in addition to that kind of self-awareness, you've got on the basis of a common ideal and a common principle. So we were in a GFR group together. We were both doing our best to put the Buddha and his teaching at the heart of our lives. You can't sit in a group week in, week out, discussing ethics and how much you love the Dharma in disharmony. I mean, maybe you can superficially, but I suggest that you wouldn't get very far or reach much real meaning. And also, I said earlier, Bhante's definition of going for refuge is essentially about being committed to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I think I can say for myself that without my love and commitment to the Buddha and the Dharma, there's no way I would have ended up in Costas. Prior to meeting the Dharma, if I fell out with somebody, if I had a difficulty, I backed off from the friendship or the relationship, either completely or by becoming kind of reserved and aloof. And the absolute last thing I would want to do would be to meet up and talk about it. And this is a tendency that remains in me. It hasn't gone away. But I do spot it more clearly these days. It can still take me quite a bit of time to engage and move towards any difficulties. And sometimes things just feel a bit too much. That's okay. I'm just working with it as best I can. But for me, one of the extraordinary beauties of our Tri Ratna Sangha and its structures is how many possibilities and opportunities we have to hang on in there, to commit. A little bit of an inward pause there. Now, obviously here I'm simply speaking from my own experience. And there are other opportunities outside of those structures, sorry, that's where I'm going, to work with communication. But for me, there is something about the structures that we have within Tri Ratna, that there's an explicitness of practice, there's a very strong sense of why we're all here. And I think that's invaluable for me. It keeps me focused. Everyone around me is holding the same ultimate ideal of enlightenment. And in my experience, in a way, there are fewer ways of escape. Akula Priya last week was talking about, when he was thinking about going for refuge, he always quite liked that idea because it involved going, and that meant probably going somewhere better. And actually, what it's actually about is staying put and realising. Staying put and realising. And I think that exactly sums up for me what's so valuable about some of these structures that we have, because you kind of have to stay put. For example, my work here at the centre, Virajyoti and I work very closely together, often in our small office. And when we began working together, it was pretty bumpy. I had quite a lot of reactions, and we often had to stop what we were doing to talk about what was going on in our communication. I think sometimes there can be a bit of a misconception that working with a collection of Buddhists must be all roses and loveliness. And sometimes you hear people say, like, oh, working with that must be so great and calm and laid back. And of course, it's wonderful in many ways, but people fall out. People have different ideas about things, want to do things differently, and people get triggered on a regular basis. Well, I get triggered on a regular basis. And in when I quoted Bhante earlier, he was talking about you need a relationship of complete honesty and harmony. And in my experience, you cannot get to the harmony until you've had some honesty. And that means going below the superficial. You can't bypass, shove down the bits that seem in conflict in order to get to harmony. Trust me, I have tried doing this, and it hasn't worked very well at all. So I have this idea, how I'm supposed to be. I'm not supposed to be angry, I'm not supposed to be upset, I must be mature at all times. And yet, of course, if I'm bringing my whole self in, then there are angry, upset, childlike selves all over the place. And there's something about owning my own experience and hearing somebody else's experience without blame, without kind of no right or wrong. But stuff needs to be heard, it needs to be witnessed before you can really see it And that can be uncomfortable. It can be really excruciating and embarrassing, humbling, ego-crushing. And yet, the more I engage with that kind of communication, the slightly less terrifying it becomes. And I have to say, trust develops. You get to know yourself in a way you never could get to know yourself on your own. I think that's really key. It's a voyage of self-discovery. I've learnt so much from Virya Joshi, who is one of the most fearless and skillful communicators I know. She regularly asks in our work sessions, is everything all right? There'll be this pause. And she means it. She wants to know the truth. Like, she's really prepared to hear it, to take time to uncover what's going on together. And I think, you know, to get to know yourself, the other person, more deeply, I always feel more connected. If we've had one of those tricky conversations where I've been like, well, actually, no, you know, you said that, and then I felt like this, and she's like, oh, but I felt like this. And you have those conversations and you just feel more connected. And instead of polarizing in opposites in some kind of, I'll use myself as an example again, some kind of like moody silence, which I'm very good at, there's just this sense of connection, of becoming closer. And I think it can really change you in quite deep ways. I've got a poem to read now, but can I just ask what the time is? Has anyone got the time?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
Okay. I'm going to read this poem because I brought it in. And actually, Linda's here, which is nice because it's a poem that Linda and Virya Joshi reminded me of at Demota's funeral. Virya Joshi got up and was talking about Demota and said, oh, and I just remember this beautiful poem that she brought to this study day, and it was really gorgeous, but I can't remember anything about it. And then straight after, Linda got up and pulled out some lines from this poem that she had in her pocket that she'd remembered from that day. It's very moving. And it reminded me of this poem, which I love this poem. It's so beautiful. And I think it describes vital mutual responsiveness, actually. It describes two angels facing each other across an abyss. And they've come into some kind of conflict. They're slightly at odds with each other. So it's called A Vision, and it's by Denise Lervatov. Two angels among the throng of angels paused in the upward abyss, facing angel to angel. Blue and green glowed the wing feathers of one angel, from red to gold the sheen of the others. These two, so far as angels may dispute, were poised on the brink of dispute, brink of fall from angelic stature. For these tall ones, angels whose wingspan encompasses entire earthly villages, whose heads, if their feet touched earth, would top pines or redwoods, live by their vision's harmony, which sees at one glance the dark and light of the moon. These two hovered dazed before one another, for one saw the sea-feathered, peacock-breakered crests of the other angel's magnificence, different from his own. And the other's eyes flickered with vision of flame petalings, cream-gold grain-feather glitterings, the wings of his fellow. And both in immortal danger of dwindling, of dropping into the remote forms of a lesser being. But as these angels, the only halted ones among the many who passed and repassed, trod air as swimmers tread water, each gazing on the angelic wings of the other, the intelligence proper to great angels flew into their wings, the intelligence called intellectual love, which, understanding the perfections of scarlet, leapt up among blues and greens strong-shafted, and among amber down illumined the sapphire bloom, so that each angel was iridescent with the strange newly seen hues he watched, and their discovering pause, and the speech, their silent interchange of perfection, was never become a shrinking to opposites. And they remained free in the heavenly chasm, remained angels, but dreaming angels, each imbued with the mysteries of the other. So I think this poem is about vital mutual responsiveness. You take a discovering pause. You really look and explore, and that exploration is transformative. These angels don't shrink to opposites, to small polarized positions that it can be so easy to take and to get into. These angels take on the beauty of each other, and they become imbued with knowledge, and they remain free. And they remain angels, but they remain dreaming angels. It's like they've evolved somehow, elevated themselves in a way to a higher plane. So I think the Sangha can also function as, I was listening to another excellent talk on Free Buddhist Audio by Sangha Mani, gave a talk at the International Gathering earlier this year on Sangha as transformation, I think it's called, something like that. But she talks about the Sangha as a hall of mirrors, which I really liked. You get yourself reflected back time and time again. And certainly for me, to begin with, when I was coming across these difficulties, like say in Ipswich with my friend, I would believe it to be the fault of others. They're behaving like this, so this is why I'm feeling like this. But after the same scenario comes up for like the 10th time, I start to realise, you know, hang on a minute, I felt and reacted exactly like that other time, with that other person. And there's just this uncomfortable realisation that the common denominator in these scenarios is me. Why do these things keep happening? And I can see my patterns. And I have to say, personally, I don't know of a clearer, more effective way of seeing those patterns than in relation to other people. Seeing more and more deeply the truth that mind creates world, actually. It's not the other way around. Banti says, in what does progress in the spiritual life really consist? What are we really learning? The knowledge we need in the end is self-knowledge, and the real significance of the deep individual-to-individual contact that going to refuge to the Sangha involves lies in a simple psychological fact. We get to know ourselves best in relation to other people. That's from What is the Sangha? And of course, the Sangha aren't just any other people. They're people with a common devotion to the Buddha and the Dharma. Sadaraja didn't draw any attention to the beautiful picture he's drawn for the Sangha refuge. And I just noticed that those Sangha members are gazing towards the Buddha. And that is, the Sangha is, you know, we are a Sangha because we're gazing towards the Buddha. I just wanted to make that. No, if you haven't seen it, have a look. I had a close-up look at it in the tea break. It's really beautiful.
You may not immediately notice that there are monks and nuns there, but you have to look close to see it.
Yes, so people who are with a common devotion to the Buddha and the Dharma, and they can be people who are really willing to go there with you, to speak their truth to you. And it's so inspiring when somebody's really with you. I have a friend who I have a confession practice with. We talk once a fortnight. And over the years, we've really laid ourselves bare. We've fallen out. We've confessed the most excruciating, kind of mean, small states of mind to each other. Kula Priya talked about a garland of shame last week, which I really liked. I definitely relate to that. Like, there is something very beautiful in really owning exactly where you're at, exactly where your mental states are at. And we've gone on a journey together and that exploration. And that's been messy, it's been uncomfortable, and our friendship is without doubt one of the greatest joys of my life. And so embarking, thinking about confession, embarking on this journey of communication, this endeavour to vital mutual responsiveness, I find it pretty scary. Like, a lot of the time I don't really know what I'm doing. But we have a map. We have a map. We have the simplest, most comprehensive guidance we could wish for. And that's our ethical precepts. With those five or ten precepts, you know, the ten precepts have additional speech precepts in them. We have all we need to know to show us the way. And I fall short and break these precepts over and over again, and they show me how to change. They show me how to transform. I can look at an interaction with someone through the lens of those precepts and with the help of a good friend who is also holding those precepts as the main thing. I can see clearly and I can see the truth and I can see how to step closer to embodying and becoming that truth. And actually what's dawned on me throughout the process of writing this talk is this voyage of self-discovery, this uncovering of habits and patterns and beliefs that is working out through communication within the Maha Sangha. Of course, I don't know why it didn't dawn on me before, but it has a direct correlation between what goes on for me and my going for refuge to the Arya Sangha, to the Sangha of Enlightened Beings. The patterns I'm becoming more and more familiar with, I mentioned them earlier, withdrawal, kind of isolating myself, my aversions, all my kind of unintegrated bits, they come into play and they get in the way of my going for refuge to the Buddha and to my relationship with the truth. A few days ago, I met with one of my Kalyana Mitras, Kalyana Mitra being a good friend who's further along the path than me and has pledged to be my friend. Thank you for that. I hadn't spoken to Rosina for quite a while, actually, but because of the nature of our relationship, it wasn't long before I was talking openly and honestly about what was going on for me. I'd been unwell for some time, and I hadn't meditated for about 3 weeks. I was feeling really lost, and because of my connection with her, built on our going for refuge to the Buddha and the Dharma and absolute honesty and knowing she's a true spiritual friend, I knew she wasn't going to collude with me. I knew she wasn't going to go, "Oh, that's all right. Don't worry. You know, you've not been feeling well." I mean, she didn't say, "Oh my," you know, she wasn't horrified. But she was very, very up for kindly exploring what was going on in that. Like, why wasn't I sort of feeling able to go there? And I need that perspective. I wouldn't necessarily go there myself. And it's interesting for me to see that as a kind of going for refuge, but I think it is. And those kinds of conversations, when you're really talking about your practice, whether it's difficulties or whether it's inspirations, are always so uplifting. And I've no doubt that I couldn't continue practicing without those kinds of communication. For me, they're a real lifeblood of my practice. So at the beginning of this talk, I talked about two sanghas you can go to refuge to. The Arya Sangha, the community of enlightened beings. I have no doubt that this Sangha is in harmony. The light of enlightenment shining through them all. There's no greed, hatred or delusion in the noble Sangha amongst enlightened beings that would be clouding or blocking that light. Now our Maha Sangha, let's be honest, considerable amounts of greed, hatred and delusion are fogging up the glass. And what going for refuge to the communication within our kind of our Maha Sangha, almost our mundane Sangha, although I'm not sure that's a good word to use actually, is but that process of communication between us is how we clean up the glass. It's how we can remove the greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think we can only do this together through our communication with each other, in real communication with each other. On the basis of our going to refuge to the Buddha and to the Dharma. It's messy. We get it wrong. But our commitment to what we know to be good, what we know to be true, keeps us engaging and keeps us trying. And sometimes we see what is possible. I've been in groups where maybe there's been a difficulty in communication that's been explored, or an open and honest discussion on how people are practicing and their inspirations. And you come out feeling uplifted. You come out feeling a bit bigger. You've got a wider perspective. You've really experienced yourself in relation to others. It's not just about, you know, meeting up with like-minded people, actually. It's about really honestly opening up in communication. You know, in a study group, you might be talking about the Buddha and the Dharma, and we're really bringing ourselves in relation into our highest, to our highest values. A team working in harmony, or indeed exemplifying how to work through difficulties, is an extraordinary thing. And sometimes it's tangible, you can feel it, something greater is coming through. And ultimately what we're doing in all this exploration of ourselves with others is discovering we're simply a bundle of habits, conditioning. We possibly learn to take ourselves a bit less seriously. We learn to get over ourselves and get ourselves a bit out of the way, and which can let that light shine through. Going for refuge to the Sangha, communication within our Sangha is fundamentally an insight practice. Banti says, in the end, narrow pseudo-religious individualism is transcended. There is only a spiritual community of individuals who are, as it were, transparent to each other, individuals through whom the light of enlightenment shines. So look around at who is here. We're part of a truly extraordinary thing. A community of individuals who've heard the Dharma. I mean, think of how many people in the world have yet to hear the Dharma, who may never hear it. We are in the vast minority, and yet here we are. What fortunate beings. And our Sangha, the Sangha of people sitting here, the Sangha in the rest of Cambridge, throughout the rest of the world, gives us the vital conditions to practice and opportunities to experience the truth. And it's so precious. Banti says, no, there's no future for Buddhism without a united, committed spiritual community practicing together. So let's take some discovering pauses. Take some risks in our communication, both with ourselves and with others. It's the main thing. Life is short. Life is really short. And we have this precious opportunity with an extraordinary group of people around us, and for who knows how long. So may our communication with one another be Sangha. May we become dreaming angels, a community of enlightened beings, a pure force of beauty, goodness, and truth throughout the world. Thank you. Mm-hmm.